Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by Jamie Monroe, a scion of the lacrosse community, a recurring guest on the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. And we are here to talk about the PLL Championship, the summer of pro lacrosse. Jamie has experience in pro lacrosse in addition to being the head coach of the Denver Pioneers and the founder of 3D Lacrosse. He was also on the Atlanta Blaze staff and knows a lot of those characters very, very well. And as always, we enjoy talking lacrosse with Jamie. Thanks for joining us. How are you doing?
Doing great, Terry. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. So we are recording this on Friday morning. Last night, the PLL semifinals advanced both the number 7 seed Chaos and the number 1 seed Whipsnakes to the PLL Championship game this weekend. This will be coming out before that game. And I want to start in a place that, I don't know, you might have expected, you might not. You have known Andy Towers for how long exactly?
Well, I have known Andy since probably around 1985, 86, when I was a freshman at Brown. His brother Tommy was a sophomore. Tommy and I became great friends, and then Andy was a recruit and then became a member of the team. When I was a senior, he was a freshman, and we've been just great friends with the Towers family for a long time.
And he, of course, is the coach of the Chaos. The Chaos went 0-4 in the championship series group play, and that extended a losing streak that dated back to last year, and I believe that they had lost 7 games in a row. They come out as the number 7 seed and take on the number 2 seed Chrome squad on Tuesday night in the first round of the elimination round, and just put in an unbelievable offensive showing. I believe they won 19-11. One of the biggest headlines coming away from that was Connor Fields, the star from Albany, who has been, you know, a really blossoming pro lacrosse player, didn't play. He was benched after having started in the prior 4 games. And the narrative coming away from that was how much the ball was moving. So can you speak to 2 elements of that? First, like just the gall and how what it represents in terms of Andy's approach that he would make such a drastic move as that. And then also the fact that presumably the outcome paid off.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that if you look back to the way the Chaos, who did have the best regular season record, the way they finished was very much the way they started in this 2020 PLL Championship Series, with not great offense, not good chemistry, not great ball movement. The ball was dying in sticks, and it wasn't just dying in Connor Fields' stick, although it died in his stick more. But I think everybody else was feeling like they needed to make a play because they weren't going to get chances to do it. And when you play like that, you just don't win. And gosh, what, you know, it did take a lot of gall to make that move. And not only did he not start, I mean, he didn't even get in the last 2 games, but they're playing lacrosse the way that you expect a group of Canadians to play, which is Canadians and box players are great at moving without the ball, and they're great at moving the ball. It's been absolutely pure joy to watch.
So there are very few folks who have evangelized the assets and merits of the 2-man game, of a lot of the other principles of box lacrosse fundamentals applied to field lacrosse. So let's take this back to 2 weeks ago. What were your expectations for this Chaos team when you considered that not only did they return a lot of the offensive firepower from last year, but they also had guys like, and you know, I understand that they were a part of it, but they weren't necessarily as prominent as they were expected to be this year, in guys like Dane Smith and Austin Stotts, who, you know, really represent kind of that other midfield that, you know, complements the bomb squad group, so to speak, but are, you know, NLL MVP caliber players. I mean, these guys are not your traditional right. second midfielders. So what were your expectations for Chaos offense coming into this tournament?
Well, my expectations were that they would have started the way they've kind of played here down the stretch of the last 2 games. And I think they totally could have. They just didn't have the chemistry. I mean, this is, you hate to say it, but this is like the perfect example of addition by subtraction. You eliminate one element of Connor Fields, who, by the way, I love the way the guy plays in so many ways. He's an absolute example of how to use skill and deception in your game. But it's also an example of, you know, team lacrosse, the ball has to move. So I did expect that. I mean, Blaze Reardon, who I've gotten a chance to know over the last several months during quarantine and stuff. Great guy, and just what a show he's putting on. And defensively, you know, returning Jared Newman, the defensive player of the year. But I'll tell you, I think Jack Rowlett is probably the best defenseman on that team right now. I mean, that guy is just absolute lockdown, tough competitor. So glad he's back in the lineup after probably having a little concussion there.
Well, yeah, let me jump in there because I think that there's a lot to be said about – I mean, that ultimately was why I was down on the chaos coming in, because when you take away Johnny Surdick, who is just an absolute physical freak. I mean, he – you know, I think he made his bones and people really popped when he did such a nice job at Army guarding Pat Spencer. But for me, going to the Army-Navy game and seeing him in person was when I was just like, oh my goodness, this guy athletically is on another level. And and so he was unable to participate because of his commitments to the military. And then Brody Merrill, who was, you know, I mean, he's probably the best defender of all time, if not right there neck and neck with Dave Petromala. Right. And has certainly, I mean, he, at this stage in his career, you know, 15 years as a professional represents a combination of, you know, both in terms of his ability to compose things off ball, as well as, I mean, he's, in my opinion now, absolutely the best blindside double teamer that there is. I mean, his ability to throw really accurate checks and land on sticks for, you know, those types of players is fantastic. When you turn your head, Brody Merrill's going to come and take the ball away from you on the backside. So I just didn't see how their defense was going to come together in that way, and certainly the way that it has, playing a lot better and really relying heavily on a goaltender, I think, is in my opinion, what it comes down to.
Yeah, although, I mean, they're playing good defense. They've got good shorties. You know, and the addition of Coates and the addition of what's the shorty's name that they got from Calgary? You know what I'm talking about.
Tyson Bell.
Yeah, Tyson Bell, Coates, and Noble.
Yep.
Those guys are experienced world-class players that you know, every year the Canadians are able to play us, the Americans, to a close game and have beaten us two out of the last four world championships. And they've got the core of that defense in there. In many ways. And their backup goalie, Dylan Ward, might be the second best goalie in the whole tournament, which is kind of crazy to think.
I was thinking about that last night because I don't know that Dylan Ward has ever lost a championship game. So, like, if you're talking about galling coaching moves, how about putting in your backup who hasn't played a minute in the event as a way to throw off a defending champion, haven't lost in the amount of time that you hadn't won in over the course of the last like 7 or 8 games in the Whipsnakes. The last thing I want to talk about with respect to the chaos is Thomas Kelly is winning at 36%. The Chaos were one of, I believe, two teams that only dressed one face-off guy. And ultimately, in the last two games, it hasn't proven to matter, although he played a lot better in their semifinal victory.
Absolutely.
And that was, you know, certainly a factor in the outcome of the game.
Huge. What was the stat last night, Terry?
I believe he was 1/500. So I believe he won.
One over. I mean, that's huge. Yeah. In this league, I mean, with such a short shot clock, if you can make saves and play decent defense, you're going to get the ball back. And it's hard to withstand the total beatdown of, you know, 19 out of 24 or something like that. But if you're anywhere near 50-50, the Chaos are psyched. I was trying to figure out what happened to TK, because he was the reason why Towers went with one faceoff guy was because he was like, we've got a guy that can clamps, win the clamp better than any other statistically person last year in the league. And TK lost a bunch of weight. He worked his butt off and he was just getting out quicked. And I don't know what happened, but he bounced back and really competed last night. So huge for them. And I don't know how he'll do against Nardella, but I'll say the Redwoods, they battled to the point where Nardella wasn't necessarily the MVP of that game. He didn't take over the game the way I thought he could have with goal scoring off the faceoff quite to the degree that I thought he could have. Although maybe one of the two pointers might have been off that. I think it was kind of off a Nardella type of play, but it wasn't just pure faceoff domination. So maybe TK's had a little altitude issues in the first week or something, and is just sort of getting his legs underneath him or something. I don't know.
Well, let's shift gears to talk about the Whipsnakes, because as you mentioned, they emerged 13-12 overtime victors over the Redwoods, which was a rematch of last year's championship and the fifth time these teams have played. The Whipsnakes have now won the last four after losing the first one. Folks probably don't remember, but in the second matchup in the regular season in 2019, they put an absolute beatdown on them in Albany, and I believe won 18-4 or 18-5. So this Whipsnakes team has had the Redwoods number, but ultimately needed overtime to survive and advance to the championship and, you know, as I said, extend that win streak. For me, what I think is so interesting and what I think that you can shed a lot of light on as a former college coach is when PLL was faced with this challenge of how do we construct our rosters, right? We've got this player pool of 150-plus guys. And we don't necessarily have team identities, meaning that like we can make choices around, are we going to put a lot of guys that went to the same college together? Are we going to put a lot of guys that had played previously on the same pro teams together? And so, you know, they ultimately settled on what represents, I think, kind of a hodgepodge of those two things. I mean, certainly, you know, you saw a lot of the Archers played together on the Ohio Machine, whereas, you know, for all intents and purposes, the Whipsnakes are a Maryland alumni team. And I'm curious as to your point of view on how much of an advantage that is, both in terms of a traditional pro lacrosse season and in terms of a 16-day, 17-day quarantine when chemistry, I don't know, I don't want to say it lives on a knife's edge, but it can be really impactful when you just can't get away from people if you get sick of them. How much of an advantage, do you think it's more of an advantage to have a group of guys that presumably like each other because they have so much history? I mean, these are, you know, probably each other's best friends who are, you know, best men in their weddings and stuff like that because they spent their, you know, four formative years of playing college lacrosse together. Do you think that's more of an asset in a season-long environment or in a shortened quarantine-type environment?
Wow. Tough question there. I'm not sure if there's a right or wrong answer, but, I mean, certainly what the advantage – The advantage that the Maryland guys have is they know their roles and their pecking order so well that they play great team lacrosse on both sides of the ball. And, you know, if you look at, you know, the Chaos, they weren't playing great because they didn't have their roles squared away. And so I think in a short tournament where you just don't have a whole lot of time to get it together, you know, I think that there's an incredible advantage there. But of course, over the long haul, there's more time for pitfalls and emotions and more losses and time to brood over it. So, you know, I'm not sure if there's an exact answer one way or the other, but I think it's huge. And, you know, certainly the way that the Redwoods were able to play defense last night was a reflection on the Notre Dame side of things and the way that they competed. And I look at the Chaos now and I say they are the classic example of the way the Canadians are always able to put together a great run in world championships. They're kind of used to these formats of tournaments like Man Cups and Minto Cups where it's 10 days of a lot of intensity. And, so I think really you're looking at the two teams that have been able to put together the best amount of chemistry.
And they represent a very, very different approach to, I don't want to say the value of winning, but, you know, ultimately when in a tournament, when every team gets in and every team has an opportunity to win a championship, regardless of how they perform in the quote unquote regular season group play or pool play, whatever phrase you ascribe to it, the value of winning is obviously zero, right? Like a team that went 0-4 is now playing for a championship. Whereas on the flip side, yep, the Whipsnakes either cared about winning or couldn't help but win because they were better than everybody. So now they're 5-0 this year. I believe they won their last three games last year, which means they're on an 8-game win streak. And I guess my question is, how good are they? Like, and asked more directly, I don't want to say, is this the best pro lacrosse team you've ever seen? Because I think it's just two apples to oranges. But how good are they in the context of this Whipsnakes team is awesome? Their goal differential in their first four games was plus 18, which means they were winning by an average of more than four goals per game. It's outrageous. And, you know, the league was structured in a way that was supposed to promote parity. And here we are with a dominant team. How good are the Whipsnakes?
I mean, they're so good, and I feel like it's hard to imagine that they're better than they were last year, given the fact that they lost so many good players in the expansion draft. But, you know, They kept their defense intact and allowed some of their offensive guys to go. And I would say you add Zed, Carlson and Brad Smith, and I hate to say it for those guys that left, but I feel like those are upgrades. I mean, Zed is just an absolute beast, box skills with just off the charts athleticism. Rambo's Rambo. Brad Smith is just what a player. He's huge. He's 6'3", 210. And he dodges with his head up. He had 5 assists last night, but he also has just a repertoire of moves that's just absolutely off the charts. And you leave Chan Chuck in there, he just bangs shots, and what a feeder he is. And they've figured out great chemistry. Obviously, defensively, they kept their core intact and they're incredible team defense wise. Kyle Bernlohr is arguably is right there with Blaze is the best goalie in the league. And then of course, with the faceoffs, that is they've just got a guy that literally can score a hat trick and go 22 for 24 in a pro game, and it's incredibly at 70 plus percent on the season.
One guy that you mentioned previously, but not in that sequence right there, that I just feel like is, I mean, I don't know. I've seen a lot of stuff about him on social media, but Michael Earhart might be like, I don't even know how to frame it. He's enormous. He is very good at preventing Dodgers from running past him. He slides effectively, right? So he does the thing, because this is one of the things that you hear really defensive-minded coaches get uppity about, whether it's overvaluing recruiting or overvaluing awards in the college level or whatever. But it's like the phrase is, "I like my defenseman to play defense." And the implication is that the lacrosse fans, lacrosse media, whomever, value offensive-minded or offensively productive long stick middies too highly. And my argument with Earhart is that he is incredibly proficient and incredibly productive and incredibly threatening offensively without sacrificing anything on the defensive end. And he's also a really valuable asset to Nardello in the wings of faceoffs. So I guess my question is, like, is Earhart to the rest of the long stick middie population currently what the Whipsnakes are to the rest of the PLL, to the rest of pro lacrosse?
Yeah, and it's amazing because it's kind of under the radar with some of the other guys out there that get a little bit more press. But certainly last night with 2 two-pointers, I mean that won the game for him. And you're right, defensively, he's just a monster that can run with anybody, and he just doesn't take a ton of chances. He's incredibly well schooled in his off the ball play and his ability to crowd and dodge and help and lock down his own guys. So yeah, I mean that guy is incredible, and I really look forward to actually studying the film a little bit more once it's all over. Now I'm kind of just enjoying it and looking forward to going back. But man, these guys are great. But on the flip side, you think about this matchup. They gave up, as good as that defense is, as good as Kyle Bernlohr is, they gave up what 12 goals last night to a team that I don't think has great offense. I don't think even close to as good of an offense as the Cavs. So it's going to be really interesting to see takes out. I mean, in the one the Cavs lay an egg and they only score 7 or 8 goals again. But right now, the way they're playing, I feel like the way they shoot the ball, the way they pass the ball, they're balanced now. You refer to the second midfield line as the other midfield line. I mean, that I would say that's the best line. As much as they need Jake Fracaro and Sergio Salcido to play well, I still think that the production they're getting out of Dane Smith, Austin Stotts, and Buchanan is critical to them. And man, I was really impressed with how the Redwoods defended, and I was a little surprised that the Redwoods scored as much as they did. How did you feel about that as far as their production offensively?
I felt similarly. I mean, to me, I always wonder how much there's fool's gold in games that, extend beyond 5, 6, 7 goals at one point, in terms of just what, human nature, right? Like when you're down that much, you're more willing to take chances and play fast. And when you're up by that much, you're less willing to take chances and play slow. And I just think that at that level, when the players are that good, more often than not, and considerably more often than not, we're not talking 51%, we're talking like 85% of the time, playing faster and being more risk prone is to the benefit, right? It's not true at the high school level, it becomes more true at the college level, but as the pyramid gets narrower and the players get better, playing freer is a better asset or a more advantageous thing. And so, you know, I looked at it and it was just one of those games where I don't remember what the biggest lead was. I feel like it was maybe 7-2, something like that.
8-2.
Yeah. And then as the Redwoods scored, I never really felt like the Whip Saints were going to lose. It wasn't until, you know, they scored their 12th goal with like 3 minutes to go in the third quarter. I mean, and then after that, they just fell apart, right? Like they just stopped being productive. And a lot of it was, Tim Trotter made a couple of nice saves, but really just a lot of good scoring chances where they missed the goal. So I don't know if I'm.
How
really
about the left on left matchup of Eppel on Rambo, and Eppel like the left on left V hold on Matt Rambo? Jerry Byrne had been so happy watching his V holds.
Not only
night.
That, but also just, I mean, a 220-pound Dodger against a 215-pound defender, like a guy who wasn't going to get pushed backwards.
It was pretty amazing. And then the job that they did on Zed too, it was unbelievable. How about Garnsey? You know, I feel like Garnsey really proved himself as such a big time player in this tournament. Coming out of the gate, you know, got kind of shut down on the first game of the year in the first Redwoods Whip Snakes matchup, and then just pretty much scored 2-2. Seemed like every game, and his goals are almost always dodging goals. Think about that. Like he's scoring one-on-one dodging goals.
And he's like 150 pounds.
Yeah. I mean, it's like he's figured out a cheat code on how to do it, which is another topic. But man, it is so interesting to watch him play. And he's doing it with skill and IQ and deception. He's not doing it. He's slower and smaller and not as quick as this guy every single time.
Hold on. He's also doing it with one other thing. And I want to see, do you think he holds the championship belt for the player who plays with the most emotion right now? Is there another player in pro lacrosse who plays with more emotion?
I don't know. Yeah. You know, he does play, he feeds off it too, doesn't he? It's just amazing how he just rises to these emotional peaks and how fired up he gets and stuff. So yeah, it's fun to watch that. I agree. I can't think of somebody else who competes with that right now.
But
it's just, I just love it because, you know, it really hurt him not having Jules there.
Yeah.
You know, you put Jules on that team and now the matchups matter. So all of a sudden he's getting like a second guy because you have to put your best guy on Jules. And all of a sudden he's on the, you know, how like this year, you didn't see him just catching and ripping shots very often.
Yep.
And it's just because Jules wasn't there. So he had to do it himself. And he actually did. And he had some bad goals called back too. I'll give him, you know, you should have that. I thought last night should have been a goal. And I thought the one that was called back 2 nights ago were, you know, were consistent with other calls that were goals. So, by the way, I want to talk a little bit about officiating if you want to get to it.
I do want to open up and just talk about like the entire series, but I wanted to make sure that we talked a little bit about how the Chaos and the Whip Snakes ought to match up. If you were Jim Stagnita, what would be your defensive game plan to try to slow down this Chaos offense?
I'd probably put a shorty on Thompson. And I would try to have a balance, if I could, of two poles on each side when they're playing their two man game, three man game side, and try to jam it up as much as possible and make them shoot dodging shots on the run. I'd switch everything. I'd put poles on Ficarro and Salcido. You know, it's tough because Whip Snakes don't really like to slide, which is part of the reason why, you know, so you can't just flick that switch. So that's, you know, how Scott scored goals. They just weren't sliding and those guys were able to beat matchups. So I'd probably pack it in more. I wouldn't go out and play, you know, I'd play soft on these fast guys and turn it into make them shoot and score goals on the run. With trying not to slide, but I wouldn't give him, you know, I wouldn't get out on Dane Smith, you know, I mean, I would back off on that guy.
Backing off
You
on the
know, I,
bomb squad.
well, I back off on Dane on the wings. I mean, he scores, he gets underneath you, you're in real trouble. And then we didn't even talk about Curtis Dixon, by the way,
I know.
What a freak that guy is, huh?
I mean, there are a lot of guys that we have brought up in this conversation that I feel like, and ultimately, this is the role of pro lacrosse, but it is guys who finish their college careers and are still ascending. In an era when pro lacrosse doesn't exist, those guys just don't flourish. We don't know how good they were going to be. My example is always Brendan Mundorf. Brendan Mundorf finished at UMBC in 2006. He was, I believe, an honorable mention All-American. He played that summer for Team Australia in the World Championships. And by 2010, I think he was the best player in the world, and he was on the U.S. national team, and he was a pivotal figure on that team.
Yeah.
If it weren't for pro lacrosse, he never would have made the U.S. national team, right? And it was that four-year ascendance. And so, you know, there are a lot of guys that have come up in this conversation. Like, Zed Williams was a highly touted recruit coming out. You know, he was at Virginia during the end of Dom Starge's tenure, didn't get an opportunity to play on the NCAA tournament stage. Kind of like Tom Schreiber in that way, but didn't necessarily have the midfield of the year accolades that kind of raised his level. But I don't, I mean, you and I have, you know, a mutual, he was a co-worker of yours and a friend of mine in John Torpy, and, you know, High Point played Virginia every year, and he couldn't have sung Zed's praises more highly in terms of being the most difficult guy that he said they prepared for on an annual basis. And, you know, I feel like that isn't something, you know, that matches the Silver Creek scoring records version of Zed Williams, but I don't think that matches the Virginia version of Zed Williams in people's memory.
Right.
And I think that this tournament has gone a long way toward making people understand that maybe he either always was this player, or, you know, this is the player that, this is the ceiling that this player has. And I think a lot of similar things are true for Austin Stotts, a guy who didn't go to college and never had that, you know, and Dane Smith, same thing, you know, an NLL MVP whose, you know, brother was famous. He is famous in NLL circles, but like field lacrosse players don't know him. Curtis Dixon is a guy who, you know, Alex Smith deserves a lot of credit. Dan Deckelbaum deserves a lot of credit. Jordan Hall deserves a lot of credit. Evan Crowther Washburn deserves a lot of credit. But Curtis Dixon shouldered up and took the Delaware Blue Hens to the NCAA Final Four. And they played a tremendous game against Paul Rabil's Johns Hopkins Blue Jays. And, you know, ultimately lost that. I've referenced this before. That was the game that the switch flipped, and all of a sudden I understood that Paul Rabil was one of the best passing midfielders in terms of his ability to dodge and throw through to the backside pipe. And Stephen Pizer did a great job against Alex Smith. But Curtis Dixon has been one of the best players in lacrosse for 14 years, and every Calgary Roughnecks fan listening to this knows that. But he hasn't been around consistently from a field lacrosse standpoint.
Right.
He pops up in tournaments like this in the World Championships, and people are like, oh yeah, his nickname's Superman.
Yeah, and he played in the MLL a bit, but you just didn't ever feel it. Like, you know, he was playing midfield and stuff, and now they got him on attack. And every time the Archers, which, you know, and they went on a run in the third quarter, and Dixon had a hat trick in the third quarter. I mean, it was just put the team on his back and just made plays. That one play where Boyle referenced when you look. That's when somebody runs all the way around the entire field and you blow the dead. No, stop, stop, stop. You're never going to do that in the game. And somehow he did that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know how exhausting it would be to run 360 degrees around the whole clock and then come in and have the strength to be able to, like, body your guy, get inside, and finish?
He's a special athlete. There's no question about it.
He really is. And his skills. You know, and they were pretty unlucky that he didn't bury that OT winner chance in the one. I forget which game it was now, but they lost an overtime game. And
right.
He had.
That was the Water Dogs, right?
He had. Was it? I can't remember which game it was, actually. But yeah, and then, Bat, one last thing on Austin Stotts. He's one of the guys that I've just really looked forward to watching. I got to know his brother Randy coaching the Blaze. I watched Austin Stotts since he was like 12 years old because my son Colin grew up playing in St. Catharines, and of course they were in zone 9 with Six Nations. So I've watched him at Tahoka, you know, all through minor lacrosse. It was kind of funny because the last time I saw him in minor lacrosse was his bantam year. Cause when he went to midget and everybody went to go play midget, which is your 15 and 16 year old age, Stotts went and played with the Six Nations Rebels, their
the junior
B team.
Yeah.
And then they won the Founders Cup. So he won the gold medal as a bantam. Then he won a Founders Cup the next year when he was 15. And when he was 16, he won a Minto Cup. And when he was 17, you know, I think he might have won another Minto. When he was 18, he won a Man Cup. And he just kept on winning. And I didn't see him quite as much until the 2017 Minto Cup when he won again. And he dominated, was MVP of that Minto Cup. And I've just always been blown away by his compete level, his toughness, and of course his skills, just the way that guy plays. It's really incredible to watch.
All right, we've got only a handful of minutes left. Let's talk about the championship series in total. You wanted to talk about officiating, so let's start there. I mean, you can't talk about officiating without talking about Matt Palem, right? He might be the second most famous guy coming away from this tournament after Ryan Boyle.
Totally. And I think, honestly, when I was talking about officiating, I really wasn't going to criticize bad calls, even though I feel like there was a couple of those replays that I didn't agree with. But really what I wanted to chat about was, I think that they did dial it in a little bit, but I think they just let everybody play. I thought there was too much holding. There's too much interference. There's too much slashing that takes away from the skill of the game. And I think it should be officiated for the most part, more like college lacrosse, and not allowing for the serious slashes that are going on. And I do think they've started to call it more tightly as the tournament's gone on. But I don't love the interference that they allow with pick setters, like, you know, pushing guys off picks. And, you know, it's like, you're going to call a ticky-tacky, you know, interference on a guy setting a pick, but you're going to let a defenseman like completely like blow up a pick by pushing people out of the way. So my one thing with the league that I think they did, it seems like they made a concerted effort to do this anyways, but I thought it was just way too physical early on. It took away from the offense.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, so this is going to seem like a little bit of a left turn, but I'll bring it back around, I promise. I thought that the controversy surrounding Mac Audette's trash talk at the beginning of the tournament was equivalent to the controversy around fighting at the beginning of the 2019 season. And you saw you saw the reins get pulled back on both of those things. Now, to the extent that it was pulled back by the league office versus the individuals themselves, who knows? It might not necessarily matter that much. With respect to the physicality of play, I think that the incredibly big hits and the other like large scale adjudication moments get more attention and they get more of my attention than the consistent physicality that you're talking about, the interferences that aren't called, the slashes that aren't called. It's really fascinating for a couple of reasons. Number one, coming into this tournament, you know, my mantra, so to speak, was that whoever wins it is going to have survived a war of attrition unlike any other lacrosse experience they've ever been in, because this is so much more physical than even the World Games. Because in the World Games, whether you play for the US, Canada, or Iroquois, you have built in three games that aren't going to be as physical and aren't going to be that competitive and that taxing as all of these games are. So if, yes, you get like an additional 1 or 2 days of rest relative to what you would have gotten playing in the Blue Group and then the FIL tournament in prior years, it's lost by the fact that, number one, you can lose any game, and number two, you're playing against opponents who are going to slash a lot harder than the Japanese and the English are, and they're just going to like body you up more consistently. So I thought that the officiating, to the extent that it was going to try to influence or make determinations and interpretations that were like, quote, extrajudicial, right? Like, not necessarily, like, if it's a gray area, the rule book doesn't say that we have to call it, we're going to let it shade more one direction or the other. I thought in this event, relative to last year, they might have been a little bit tighter just to help these guys preserve their bodies a little bit better. And maybe they were on a relative basis. I guess I'm not really cognizant enough of what last year's games looked like and the type of thing that you're talking about to be able to speak to that.
I'm not sure, but I mean, it's like kind of like this: would you rather watch somebody get held or watch that guy score a goal?
That was the last
So
point I was going to
that's kind of
make.
where I'm at.
That was the last point that I was going to make, which is that particularly early in the tournament, goal totals were a quote-unquote problem. Like, there just weren't enough. I mean, the unders were hitting by like 6 or 7 goals consistently. It was clear that they expected there to be more prolific offense. And by they, I don't know if I'm referring to the betting houses or if they were being informed by last year's games or, you know, commentary from coaches and Seth Tierney and other folks in leadership positions with PLL. But yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about it that, you know, whether it was man up goals or whether it was defenders reacting to what they knew was going to draw a call, that being less physical was absolutely going to be to the offense's favor. So let's just land this plane by talking a little bit more generally about the, you know, three or four teams we haven't spoken as much about. You know, let's start with the Archers. They were the other team that was eliminated. You know, we've spoken more about Redwoods. I don't know. I don't know how to feel. It kind of seems like they ran into a hot team. I don't feel any worse about how good the Archers were than I did at the beginning of the season. You know, coming into this, I probably would have said that they were the second most talented team, and that's by a field lacrosse metric, right? It doesn't necessarily account for all the talent in the box that the Chaos players have. But even then, I wouldn't have said the Chaos were better because I didn't think that they were better defensively. I thought the on balance, the Archers were the second best team. To lose in the semifinals as the favorite to a team that just has gotten very hot, I don't know how much shame there is in that. What's your interpretation of how disappointed you would be if you were in the Archers locker room?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that they were probably a little bit shocked, and I think everybody, you know, looks at the Chaos as, you know, they're just lucky to be here right now.
You can't be
On the
shocked after
one
they did that
hand,
to Chrome, though, unless you believe that Chrome just didn't show up and didn't care because they're, you know, a bunch of Duke guys that don't care about Pearl Lacrosse, which I know that that perception exists. Whether or not it's rightful, that perception exists. And it's possible that another team might say, that's not going to happen to us because we care more.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I agree with you that I think that what I said is probably it was more applicable to the Chrome. You know, like, all right,
Yes.
these guys, we handled these guys last time, and I still think there's a little bit of hangover for that from that I think would sort of be there in the back of your mind, like, we'll be good, we'll be good. You know, like, you know, I know those guys, you know, lost to, you know, they got hot, but we'll be good. They're not going to be able to stop us, you know, da-da-da-da. But, you know, what I would say is Rowlett did an unbelievable job on Amen, as did, didn't Tucker Durgan do a really good job on Amen too? And I feel like what you've kind of figured out is there are some guys that are guarding him. And, you know, there's no doubt that Schreiber, you know, made himself midfielder of the year in this tournament, and he's been incredible. Ambler, you know, love his game, huge plays. I love Currier and his off the ball. But maybe they needed, you know, maybe they needed another dodging, a real a more physical dodging threats, because, you know, Holman and Manny are great lacrosse players. But when you look at Byrne and Dixon, or you look at Rambo and Zed, you've got attackmen on two each wing that are huge problems. And so, you know, maybe that's why that they were able to be shut down a little bit, because they just didn't really have a dominant physical dodger behind the net.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I look at this game and I think that it was one of those games where you get blown out in the first half and they were down 8-3. And then your offense starts clicking in the third quarter. And it's just one of those games where you look up at the scoreboard and you're like, God damn it. If we had just played better defensively, you know, and let up one goal instead of four. You mentioned Curtis Dixon's three, you know, hat trick in that span when the Archers went on
Third
a run.
quarter.
This game would be tied. It just felt, or if not, we would be within a goal or two, and it would be winnable as opposed to the fact, you know, that we're down by four, and that to me was kind of the difference in the game. It was the fact that they couldn't more consistently get stops in the third quarter, and when you reduce the margin of success versus loss to that narrow of a gap, because again, like, yeah, you can kind of ascribe the outcome to two things: either they didn't play better offense in the first half or the fourth quarter, or they didn't play better defense in the third quarter. And to me, like, I don't know, it just felt from a game flow standpoint like it would have been a winnable game if they had just gotten a few more stops in the third. And again, when you reduce the margin to that something that narrow, I just, you know, it's like I can't. My answer to the question is that if I were the Archers, I'd be disappointed, but I wouldn't feel like it was a condemnation on who we are as a roster construction, as an approach to the game, anything like that. I would say, you know, we just didn't play our best at the wrong time.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with that. But I do think there's something to be said for the physical dodging attack.
Yep. Yeah, I mean.
Because it's a huge problem. You know, that's why it's so amazing last night that the Redwoods were able to shut down, you know, the Whipsnakes' physical dodging attack in Rambo and Zed. I mean, amazing, really. Those guys are just such a handful. It's really unreal.
Atlas, Water Dogs, and Chrome, the three teams that lost on Tuesday night. What will be your, I guess, kind of like lasting impressions from each of the three squads?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Chrome, Tim Sudan, got his Rochester Rattler boys back, and I thought they played great lacrosse. I mean, it was probably a good lesson for running your mouth too much. To go ahead and lose after you embarrass a competitor on a national TV, but I think the Chrome are excellent, and I think that they play great lacrosse. And those Duke guys are off the charts. Jordan Wolf, amazing. Gutterding, amazing. And that's kind of an example of those up to a couple of dodging attackmen that are just incredible players. And I just love the way they play lacrosse. I loved it when we competed against them when I worked for Hunts with the Blaze. And I think they play awesome lacrosse, both sides of the ball. And, you know, they ran into a buzzsaw with Chaos, but I think that they could have competed for this championship. Water Dogs, I was really surprised that they just didn't score more goals, and I was really surprised that what's his name,
Ben Reeves,
the Yale.
Yeah, Ben Reeves. Yep.
I was really surprised that Ben Reeves wasn't able to get on track to just create more offense. I mean, I'm not sure if he scored a goal in the tournament.
He finished with two assists.
Like, they needed that guy. Yeah.
And they ran the final play, a two-pointer for him. You know what I mean? Which speaks to what the team and coaching staff's regard is for him physically. I mean, he had to have shown something in practice because they're not making that decision on the basis of who he was for Yale in 2018. So my thing on Ben Reeves, you know, having talked to a couple of people who know him well and have played with him and have coached him, is, you know, it is a function of, like, he doesn't care as much about lacrosse as he cares about being a part of a team. And part of his, the way he regards himself in a team is that, like, it takes time in order for him to identify what his role should be, if his role should be the alpha male. Like, he's not going to go out and grab that ball by the horns and
just do it.
On that team, in that span of time, it seems like, you know, it didn't present himself. Or, ultimately, he's not the player that he was 2 years ago. I mean, it could be either, it could be both.
Yeah, it could be both. So fun to watch Zach Currier play. I was bummed that he got hurt, but it was great to see him come back. And just so much fun. You know, and then as far as Atlas goes, you know, I enjoy watching their individual players. I don't think they play great offense. I'm not surprised they didn't play great offense. They you know, you referenced the Hopkins Delaware Final Four with Rabel and Pizer, and in this era, that was a downhill dodging, alley dodging, skip it through the backside era, and they built their team on that. And that's just not the era that we're in right now. It doesn't mean it can't work at all, but it's not as high of an efficiency of shooting those type of shots, you know, which is the same reason why I was surprised that the Redwoods scored as much as they did. They you know, the guys would rely on alley dodges. And then, you know, having Rob Pennellan and on an attack unit with Eric Law is, you know, probably not a kind of a waste of Eric Law. Eric Law is an X guy in a very different type of X guy than Rob Pennell. Both, you know, incredible talents, but I'll take the Eric Law of the MLL Denver Outlaws all day, because he facilitated the offense and he scored a ton of goals without having to handle the ball much and getting the ball to these other guys. And so, you know, not that surprised that, that Rob Pennell ended up getting his points, but they didn't end up scoring a ton of goals. And same with Klutz. I mean, Cloutier is an incredible player, but he's kind of a ball in the stick guy. And it's hard to have a bunch of guys like that that just need the ball in their stick all the time. Ryan Brown, I forgot he was in the game, honestly. So I'm not surprised that they struggled to score goals. What was your take on that?
The same. I felt like their issues were even less at the offensive end and more at the defensive end. I felt like, I don't know, they have a lot of guys who like to play defense. They care more about the pain that they inflict than they do preventing goals from being scored, is kind of the interpretation that I entered this tournament with, and it's the interpretation that I came away with after it was all said and done as well. So, I felt like in that
Yeah, well, I agree
respect,
with you.
it's just going to be hard to win games with those two problems at each end of the field.
Well, and also overall in the league, there's definitely people in this league that are getting playing time or on these rosters that probably aren't as good as either they once were, because there's a bunch of older guys that still have roster spots, and guys that, are the face of the league or whatever, for whatever reason, that are in there that aren't. That aren't necessarily helping those teams win as much, and that's they're just locked into that a little bit from their marketing perspective, and kind of is what it is. And I think the Atlas struggled a little bit with that too.
So I think this has been a really good conversation about the PLL Championship Series. We've got time for one more, and I want to leave you with what's going to seem like a weird question, but I'm hopeful that it's going to prove prescient. And it's also a question designed for you, Jamie Monroe, lacrosse coach who thinks about lacrosse in a very unique way. One of the things that I take away from the 19 games that have happened so far is that the two-pointer has mattered more strategically than it has with consistency at any point in prior PLL or MLL seasons that I can recall. And what I mean by that is the outcome of games are changed by 2-point goals, 2-point shooting percentage, and more than just one late desperation two. Like that, there's plenty of precedent for. And if memory serves, you were involved in a MLL championship that hinged on one of those. I'm not referring to that. What I'm referring to is, games in which like the outcome was it was a 14-11 game, but that team had three twos and that team only had one. And that is literally what spelled, or that team had zero, and that's what spelled the margin of victory. Do you feel like the 2-point goal took a step forward as a strategy in the last 2 weeks?
Yeah, it seems so. I mean, obviously, last night was a perfect example, with the Whipsnakes' ability to win a one goal game with two pointers from a long pole. And one of those was really, I'm pretty sure it was off a face off type of sub game in which they just kept on waiting for Earhart to come back. In fact, Beck, maybe both of them were. And all of a sudden, it's a strategy that was really, really well employed, and for the same reasons, the Redwoods were able to get themselves. They won a game when
Sergio
Miles
had,
scored what two?
and then they
Miles
won
should
a
have
different
scored
game, and
two, and
Sergio scored two. They won two games exclusively
yeah,
because
because of
the
it.
2-point line.
Yeah. Now the sample size is small, so it's kind of hard to know. I mean, I remember being in the MLL and watching various, and watching film from the years before and stuff, and just watching where the impact of the 2-point, shot was taken advantage of. But given the fact that the 2-point line is tighter than the MLL 2-point line
Right.
is really interesting. And it was kind of, I was trying to figure out, I got a question for you on as it relates to this. Do you think that the 2-point line being tighter tightens up the defense, or do you think it extends?
So I don't think it does either. I think that, okay, so in the MLL it's 16 yards and in the PLL it's 15 yards. I think that I don't think that significantly affects defenses. I think that it would if it were 14 yards, and I am in favor of moving it to 14 yards because I think at 15 it's still a goal that is scored predominantly in unsettled play, and ultimately, like, defenses, that is just a function of where almost always it's going to be scored by shooting through a guy sliding to you, as opposed to, a guy that was actually matched up on you and in good defensive position. I think a shot from 14, like, you can come off of a screen, get a, three quarters of a step and have your hands free and hit a 14-yard shot against a pro goalie. I don't think
Tommy
you can do that
Shriver
from 15
hit a
yards. Exactly.
14-yarder on the run last night.
Exactly.
So,
Exactly.
yeah.
So I think that.
And Chanishaw hit a couple of them last night
Right.
would have been two pointers if it was a 14-yarder.
And Perkovic's twos in the game when he hit two, those came off of typical offense backside action. One was off the sub game, but the other one was late. It was a desperate shot, but it was in settled offense. So, that is a goal that theoretically needs to be defended, right? Like, you can't give up that shot. But I think if it's at 14 and it's happening, I don't know, 20% more frequently, then defenses go from this is something that, we can't really worry about it strategically because we're only ever reacting to it in scramble mode,
Certain scenarios,
to
yeah.
we are going to make decisions about extending to certain guys because there are guys that can hit 14-yard shots in the flow of a settled offense.
Yeah, I agree. I think that would be cool, and I think it'd be really, it's an exciting shot. I think people love it, and the league needs more goal scoring anyways. So you don't want 8-6 games, do you? If you're Paul Rabil.
So move it to 14 yards for 2021. Jamie Monroe, that'll do it for this edition of the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. This is a home and home. So everybody listening, in addition to leaving a rating and a review, hitting us up on social media, Jamie, what's your Twitter handle?
At Jamie Monroe 3.
Should be an easy one to find. I'm at Terrence Foy with one R, the Irish way, as my mom says. In addition to all of that, make sure to visit Jam3 Sports. And where else should they find your podcast? On iTunes, Spotify, all that sort of stuff? Jamie Monroe
Yeah,
Lacrosse
so it's
Podcast.
on. Yeah, look forward to the Phil Lacrosophy podcast. I know it's a mouthful of a name, but it's really all about lacrosse philosophy. You should be able to find it.
All right, well, we appreciate your time and look forward to continuing the conversation on your home field.
Awesome. See you soon.